Before we dive into today's conversation, I want to take a moment to thank this episode's sponsor, Audible. You know how much I love a good story. I write them, I read them, and sometimes when I can't sit down long enough to open a book, I listen to them. Lately, I've been listening to Audible while I walk, travel, or even sometimes while cooking dinner. There's something about hearing a story performed that makes it come alive in a different way. I just finished, Julie Chan is Dead by Lian Zhang, an Alice Feeney book, Beautiful Ugly, and the latest Lin Li book by Elizabeth George. So I'm going to be honest, this is how I do it. I get a book both on Kindle and on Audible, and I go back and forth listening to both. So when I'm driving in the car or with my son at some activity, I will listen to audiobooks, and then when I'm home, I read them on Kindle, and Audible makes it easy to switch back and forth in the app. Honestly, I do it every time. I want to keep the book going while I'm driving, and so I just switch to the audiobook, and then when I get home, I switch back to the Kindle, because honestly, I can read faster than I can listen. Anyway, the best part is that with Audible, you get a 30-day free trial. You can start listening today. You get one audiobook you can keep forever, even if you cancel. So if you've been wanting to read more stories that pull you in and won't let go, including my own Casey Court series, which are all available on Audible, go to audible.com. The link is in the show notes, or in the alternative ebooks.buzz/audible. Hi, and welcome to The Politics of Justice. It's me, Amy Austin. Let me say up front that as I record this, it is about 9 billion degrees in Los Angeles. There may be a hum of the air conditioner, but if I turn it off, I will be sweating on screen. And for that same reason, I actually don't have the ring light on. It's just too hot for all of that. So you're just going to have to see me the best way you can. So when I left off the last recording, I was on I had finished chapter 4. So as we start chapter 5, Casey is going to the courthouse to cash in on her favor. So the upside of access, the thing that she actually always wanted, and she talks about this across multiple books, but Casey had this fantasy that she was going to marry Tom and they were going to be this power couple and she was going to have all this access to power that she otherwise did not grow up with. That did not work out when Tom dumped her, but now he's back. He's got his own motives. We haven't even gotten to that. But now he's back and he's offering favors. And one of them is an opportunity to get these referrals from his uncle in juvenile court. But Judge Eamon Brody is a creepy creep. And as a creepy creep, he's a creepy creep and a little power hungry, which maybe those two are always married. Let me think about that. But always married together. But as like a creepy creep, he wants her to like come in so that he can like dole out the favors, you know, little by little. And he's using this thing. And this, like, the thing is, like, this has happened to me probably within the last few years, where men are like, you must come with a woman's touch. So can you give me ideas on paint, decorations, accessories, or whatever? And they want you to do all this emotional labor for them. And I actually saw an adult man pout when I refused to give him paint color samples. I was like, what color should I paint it? I was like, I don't do that. And he was like, you're not gonna help me? I was like, you're an adult man, find somebody to help you that you pay, not for free. They're not using women's labor. Moving on. So Casey goes to Judge Brody's office, and she, in the beginning of this chapter, I'm sort of like laying the groundwork a little bit more and like developing this like Cuyahoga County legal world. And in this instance, she's going to the juvenile court and she talks about like she's walking up the steps like a recalcitrant child. And one of the things, I will say this, the beautiful thing about the WPA and slightly earlier era
courthouses is they all have these grand steps. The awful thing is you got to step up all these steps. So she's stepping up all these steps. But in this case, because of the way juvenile court was run, there was only one door in and out. And it's like a 1920s, maybe earlier, maybe even late 1800s, early 1900s building. So there's only one in and out. And while the city police, county workers, and prosecutors had an express route in and out, defense attorneys and litigants had to wait their turn. So you had to stand on the steps online to get in and go through security check where they went through your coat when people didn't have heavy coats because it was, you know, Cleveland in the winter often. So coats, purses, briefcases, and so you had to have this like whole inspection, sometimes the wand, sometimes the pat down, and in order to like represent litigants. And I may have been a little resentful. I said I hated this when I was working. We were treated like common criminals when going through security. As lawyers, it took more time than it should to enter a courtroom, and God forbid you should want to step outside. Sure, you couldn't. It was like no in and out privileges. And I think I will say that there's a juxtaposition that in some courthouses, maybe federal court, I have to think about this, I don't remember this, but in some states, if you show a bar card, you can bypass some of the extra level of scrutiny and security. But that was not the case in that particular court. Actually, I believe you could go into some other courtrooms without security. This is before 9/11 and a little bit after. I think it tightened up after that. So she, you know, she makes it to his chambers in his courtroom. And he's wearing a robe, and she, like, just like out of the fleeting corner of her eye, she thinks she sees like a bare leg. And she's like, okay, I'm not gonna like think too much about that. Cause like there's a lot of jokes about what judges wear under their robes. And she's like, okay, you know, I'm too dialed into the creepy creep. She's like, but I want this favor, so let me just dial it back and like, you know, put on the professional demeanor. So she's like, she takes out a briefcase. She's like, okay, I'm going to like take out my like shiny cross pen, the gold cross pen, which by the way, I used to have, and I don't know where they went. And I'm going to take notes and I'm going to do what I do. But he does that thing where he's like, I'm going to dole out favors. So she's sitting there uncomfortable. But the only thing I will say this is that she's not wearing stockings. And when I was practicing, women still had to wear stockings. I mostly wore pants, a la like Hillary Clinton pantsuit time, mainly just so I could wear socks and shoes like a regular person. And but she's like grateful that she's not wearing stockings because it would just like cut across her and just be one uncomfortable thing. And then I wrote a note, I think, about how I'd love to meet the person for whom stockings were comfortable. Never met that. Oh my God. I feel like half of my childhood memories were like wearing stockings and slips and being like really, really uncomfortable in dress up situations. Look, it's not corsets and like the Bridgertons, but it wasn't great. Athleisure was a beautiful thing. So Judge Eamon is like stretching this out and he's like, why don't we retire to my office where we can sit and chat? And, you know, she's like thinking to herself, I'm a hungry lawyer. I need the referral. If this is like, this is the currency that I have to spend, this is what I'm going to do. So she falls into his office and I just made a side note. Most judges decorated their chambers with drab earth tones, prints of ducks or eagles or something patriotic, alongside pictures of cherubic children photographed barefoot, robed in requisite white oxfords and blue jeans. I don't know. It was a 90s like personal photography style. I haven't seen it in years. I assume it has died a death. But every office I went to, actually, this is true for like lawyers as well. And like most professionals, they would have pictures of their children and they would be wearing like white oxfords and blue jeans and barefoot for the family photos. God save us from that era. Moving on. Things are a little different now. So he's like, he is using his power to make himself feel better in the accompaniment of a woman. So he's like, what do you have on your walls at home? And what is your bedroom like? And he says, I'm sure a single girl like you has an interesting boudoir. And I said, this is a very creepy creep type of question, one that as a woman I've heard too frequently in my life, as in more than zero. But in the book, Casey's like is thinking to herself, I just had to remember that I was playing the game to get the prize. And this is true. The note I wrote is, this is how nearly all referral conversations went with men. Women would call me, give me the client name and number, and get off the phone. Men always wanted attention in exchange for their referrals. Enough said. Enough said about that. So, yeah, enough said. I will say this. I am realizing that as I'm talking about these notes. So if you go on to Goodreads, and maybe I'll include a link in the show notes, all of the highlights and notes are included on any book that I've made, highlights and notes, and they're automatically published to Goodreads when I make them in my Kindle copies. So she's waiting. He's giving out the information as slowly as possible. But she's thinking about giving him like cliche decorating ideas, she's going to get like thousands of dollars worth of referrals in her pocket. And this is just the exchange. So she is, once he gives her that name, she like closes her briefcase. She's like ready to run. And it's only when she gets outside of the courtroom in his chambers that she realizes that she left the pen. And for her parents, buying her this gold pen was very expensive and like a very thoughtful gift. And the kind of thing, like the gold cross she wore with her mom that gives her, she wears around her neck sometimes, that they might be likely to ask about. So she's like thinking, she's like doing that. Wait, how important is it to get the pen back versus creep creep? And she realizes that like, or she comes to the conclusion that everybody's professional and she is just going to like go in and get this pen. So she sees like a black woman go in and she's thinking, you know, I thought his chambers were empty, but again, none of her business. So she's like goes back into the office and it's like pushes the door to the chambers open. She should have knocked. I don't know. There's no way to get this. And like goes in to get the pen. And when she takes the brass knob and pushes the door in, she realizes that she sees something that she shouldn't see. And he's saying to this black woman, bend over Rhonda. And she said the woman whose naked brown flesh was out of place in his office became visible when her elbows hit the desk. And she says, Judge Brody, I forgot. And he looks her in the eye and Rhonda looks in the eye and she runs out of there. She's like, I know what I saw and no pen is worth that. But she gets, so after she leaves, she gets on the bus. So I will say this, and this is a thing that actually a lot of lawyers did. There was like a loop, I think it was called the loop bus. The loop. So there's a bus that like went downtown between like all the big government buildings. And once you parked your car, in my case, I didn't always drive a car. I usually took public transportation. But once you were downtown, you weren't moving your car. So just like the court, no in and out privileges. So you would just take the loop bus between like all the government buildings. And while she's on the bus, she is freaking out. She's getting this sort of like gross and creepy feeling, like the thing that she saw happened to her. I don't know if it's like secondhand trauma. I don't even know what you would describe that as, but she's like freaking out over having seen what she thinks is probably not consensual sex and probably is assault. And it's just like messing with her mind. But she's like compartmentalizing, which is a lot of people do, and she's just like soldiering forward. So she runs to her office. She like her like assistant has set up this lunch with a client, and she runs to the club and to just like have lunch and like put it in her mind. So the next chapter, it's Claire on the same day. So Claire is home with her son Luke with the broken arm. And she is just beside herself. because she's feeling so much guilt for having made the decision to leave her son with his father and not being vigilant enough to not prevent his broken arm. And obviously this is not her fault, but she's got mom guilt. What am I going to say? She's got mom guilt. I mean, if my son broke his arm, I don't know if I care where he was. I'd feel like, oh my God, I should have somehow prevented that. And for every person I know whose child has broken something, they have talked about it. And this is after I wrote this book, but I have like observed this in my life. Like I've had friends, especially with like the scooters or the hoverboards or the, I don't know. There was a time when everybody's kid fell off those things. I don't even know what they're called. I think it was the hoverboard, or maybe the scooter. And then there's some other like little micromobility thing that was popular like 5-10 years ago. And a lot of my friends' kids broke things and they just feel so much guilt, even though it's not necessarily a preventable accident. So she's feeling all this guilt. And then Darius, her ex, comes over and he's like, I wanted to check up on him. And he says, and this is something that's interesting because I'd forgotten about this element of the book. He says, oh, it's a torus fracture. And she says, when are you going to do something with their certificate? So when they met, Darius had said that he was in college, but it turns out he was in a radiology tech program and he'd finished, but hadn't taken advantage of the job placement, she says. And he's like, I've been looking. And she's like, you've always been looking. Why can't you get a job? And she's sort of in this, I don't even know, I don't call it a pit. How can I say this? She had an intact family and parents who had like solid government jobs. And Claire had a very certain expectation of herself and the kind of life that she would have. And it would be markedly different from the kind her parents have. So her parents like are professionals and, you know, like have government jobs and solid income and a home and all of that. But she thought by going to law school, she was going to elevate just like a certain level above that into like a certain professional class. And having met Darius, and like the chapter tells the story of how he met her like on a bus, that he sort of like pulled her back down into a place that she never wanted to be. And this is a tension, at least, well, I know of in like the Black minority community. I'm not going to speak to any other communities where we live in a society that's always like, get an education, get a job, become more than, you know, your parents were, but then also speaks to you being egalitarian and dating within your group because you can bring each other up together, but also if we can drag each other down together. And that is a constant tension that I know people experience in the Black community, but probably something we don't talk about too much in public. But I can see it even now, like watching like various shows, like I'm all into this single reality show. Fortunately, I quit the streaming service, so I'm good right now. Where there's this constant tension between like trying to like live this like rich professional life, but still having people in the community or in your family who are not on that level, and having to feel like you have to like walk this tension, where other families who, and you meet them in life, who are like, my father was a lawyer, my grandfather was a lawyer, my great grandfather went to Harvard or whatever, have never had to walk that line. So in this chapter, she like reminisces about how she met him on a bus and she didn't want to talk to him, but he like, for reasons, he was uncompelling, probably just good looking and like charming. And she ends up talking to him and going to a party and unfortunately getting pregnant when she was in law school at the time. And even though she had not like gotten like the white shoe job, the kind that Casey lost, she was like, was going to get a solid government job, and it may not be glamorous and certainly the kind of job that hundreds of thousands of Black women are being fired from in this current administration. It was going to be like a solid life that she could count on for herself. And despite all that she put into place to do that, she got waylaid by this guy. And so he's in her house, like, well, like she's sort of like lamenting about this past and how she got here. And at some point, she's like, what are you doing? You know, why aren't you working? And he admits that, like, he caught a felony. He wasn't the perpetrator. He got caught up in something. And it just, like, really, like, pulls her down. And it starts her, like, longing again for the kind of life that she believes that Miles can provide for her. And the tension goes on. What happens in the end, we will see. But she knows that Darius would like them to get back together, and her son would like her to get back together, but she can't be in this family unit with this guy, now with a felony and a radiology degree or something. And when Miles is out there, who's like the Ivy League graduate with the parents with like of a certain class, and like sort of represents her way out in the same way that Tom Brody represents a way out for Casey. It's sort of like they're parallel tracks where these women are just maybe looking for somebody to save them when they can't save themselves, and are in this constant tension of trying to figure out if they can do it for themselves, or do they have to wait for that hand down or hand up from a man that could save them. So in chapter 7, Casey's basically in the club, the union club, having the lunch with Marissa Ellingwood, and she's not doing the best job that she can because she's completely unsettled by this thing she just saw with Judge Brody. But she pulls it together in the end, gets the client. So the thing I say about Marissa is, because Marissa's going to be in juvenile court, and because clearly she's unmarried, she says, I'd been brought up in a fairly observant Catholic home. Though my family wasn't ultra religious, even I knew better to show up to mass knocked up and unwed. Because like Claire, like there are these like things that you always want to avoid. And like the two of them were like unwed mother. And in the 80s and 90s, like being an unwed mother was like a fate worse than death, societally. And so there's like a lot of angst in this book about trying to avoid that and what happens to women who can't avoid it. Even though clearly, you know, it doesn't take one person to make a baby. So one of the things that I admire about Casey is that in this book, you can see the beginning of her growth. And she says to Marissa, well, we'll do our best to keep your kids with you. I said in a way that I hope sounded soothing. I learned earlier on in my career never to get a client's hopes up. Much of the practice of law was managing expectations, which is true because you can't, even if people have like the perfect case, you can't make promises because you can't control the judge, you can't control the jury, you can't control facts and circumstances like that are outside of what you originally know. So you manage expectations to the best degree possible. So at the end, as much as we see that Casey has had some growth, we see it's not perfect because she says, when Marissa penned a check with what I now saw was her inbred European flourish and handed it over without hesitation, I knew I'd charged a big client too little once again. I promised myself in my anemic bank account that I wouldn't make the same mistake a third time. So I believe the retainer she charged Sheila Harrison Grant was $2,500, and the amount that she charged Melissa Ellingwood, I believe, is $10,000, and it's still not enough. And this is like a lesson that lawyers learn. Like every so often, I pop my head into like women lawyer groups online, and people are still having this problem. You have to charge enough up front to cover the case, basically, because on the back end, you may not get money. And as student loans are not dischargeable, you can't write off debt for services, for attorney services. I don't know about other personal services, but I know we could never write off debts. So you just had to eat it. So we're up to chapter 8, and it's a Claire chapter again. And at this point, she has decided that Darius is a danger to her son. She calls and asks her parents for money because she is going to take him to court. So the thing she says to her parents, and, you know, she has to eat a lot of crow for this, is that they were 100% right about Darius and his arm got broken when like it was, he was in his custody, and now it's time for me to like take charge of his life. And she said, I made a mistake with Darius. I admit it for the 100th time. And this is true. And I read about this yesterday in a different context, but it says sometimes families never forget even the smallest lapse in judgment. And actually I read like random advice columns, and one of them the other day, somebody was updating like the commentariat, as it were, about the advice that had been taken and given. And this person had like changed jobs like 4 or 5 years ago. And she was talking about how her parents still talk about how it was the biggest mistake of her life. And I'm like, oh my God, you're in your 30s and you have to live with your parents talking about how changing jobs is the biggest mistake. And it's actually not a mistake. It's just different. And in the end, it actually worked out because the previous job she had was a Doge job that she wouldn't have had if she had kept it. So, but there are some families where if you go hat in hand, you have to eat crow and admit to every mistake they think you've ever made before they will help you. And sometimes that's the price. I don't know, maybe the theme of the book is that sometimes you have to pay a lot of really awful prices to get what you want. But she talks about how working for this nonprofit, so she worked for Sheila Harrison Grant, if you don't remember. And when Sheila left her job, she lost her job because judges always hire their own clerks. It's rare that a judge will take somebody else's clerk, although I saw it once when I think the judge had died. And so the new judge was just going to finish out the old clerk's term. But people, it's often the same with political appointments. People hire their own people. So when the judge or politician leaves, you're out of a job. And so she talks about working for UWMA and how it's a minuscule salary because nonprofit salaries are often smaller, with the idea that you're like giving up part of the salary for A, the working conditions, and because you believe in the mission of the organization. The note was, working for a nonprofit is an interesting conundrum for employees. Many pay barely livable wages, but expect a huge employee commitment because of the cause. It's something I saw many go through 20 plus years ago, and little has changed since then. It's true. When you read about it now, nothing has changed. So at the end of this chapter, you learn that Claire has hired Casey, that she's going to hire Casey to represent her in juvenile court to try to get custody of her son, Luke. And she said that she'd been good enough to recommend to the judge, then she'd been good enough for me. And the note says, this was how Sheila Harrison Grant and Judge came to hire Casey Court. I believe at some point in the book, and Judge Sheila Harrison Grant asked Claire for a recommendation, and Claire recommended Casey. Don't quite know how she found Casey, but who knows? As in later in this chapter, it switches POV, which actually I rarely do. I wonder why I did it in this book. It doesn't switch POV. It's just later. It's later when Claire goes to see Casey, and Casey looks up and she's like, oh, I thank you for the referral. And she says, the reason Claire, I guess Claire maybe could represent herself. I don't know. I never thought about that. But she says, we can't all be experts in everything, especially with specialization and the law the way it is. So she's like looking for Casey to save her. I guess a lot of people are looking for a lot of people to save them, or maybe looking for a professional to help them. Maybe that's a better way of looking at it. No, this actually is from Casey's point of view. So weird. One of the things I learned in writing was one chapter, one point of view, because my first couple of books, I switched point of view in chapter, and it's very difficult narratively to write, follow, and difficult for readers, I think. Not if you're Nora Roberts, but for everybody else. Well, that's head hopping. But I think that I really tried to be very structured, and it's odd that I broke the structure here. So, but it's only book two of the series. I was learning. So at some point, Claire says, look, here's my issue. I have a son, Luke, and I never married his father. I watched her scratch notes in the pad, and I wonder if she realized, even though I sounded like a stereotypical Black mother having a baby out of wedlock, I was the exception, not the rule in my family. Oh my God, all of this like guilt that you put out there. And actually, I'm thinking about it now. So the big buzz news, like in the gossip world, is that this woman, Taylor Frankie Paul, is not going to be the Bachelorette based on like some domestic violence allegations. But what's interesting when I'm looking at Black creators is that they do recognize that if this woman had been a Black woman with different children by different fathers and involved in like domestic violence on film, people would be dragging her to the ends of the earth. I'm not saying they're not dragging this woman, but they did not think it was a disqualification to be on, I guess, two different reality shows. Whereas for a Black woman, it would be a completely different sort of thing. And it's something that comes up, and Claire is super self-conscious about this because she keeps talking about it in this book. So, but Casey, to be frank, is not really thinking that deeply about it. So, so Casey's like, have you ever tried working it out? And Claire's like, clearly you haven't met Darius. So it's, these women are now on a path together and to try to like sort this out. And you never, obviously there, it's a collision course because it's a book, but this is like the beginning of the book where you now, like, we now know who the players are. It's Miles, Claire, and Casey, and they're all on a collision path. So with that, I'm going to end up with chapter 8, and this end this with the end of chapter 8. And in the next video, I'll obviously start with chapter 9. But I'm starting to see some emergent themes, which are interesting, where these women are looking. Well, A, there's creepy creeps. Let's not forget the creepy creeps. But we're living in the creepy creep world right now. I mean, if the headlines weren't Epstein, then there's Cesar Chavez. And it's just, it's a creepy creep world. And I think women, we're just living in it. But let me say, that's a great way to let it end. But the other theme I think is, it's so interesting that in this book, that these women are looking for saviors. And well, we'll see if they can be saved. If you know, Miles can help Claire, like pull Claire out of from one world into another, whether Tom can like pull Casey. I mean, Tom can pull Casey from one world into another. But there's a lot of hope between these women that somehow these men can elevate them and change their life trajectory. And I don't know if that's gonna happen.